All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 46 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We're returning to the theme of Spartan history here today. We're going to keep revising or reviewing that context of overall kind of the connection between modern life and ancient history via the Power of the Land chart / timeline. Of Anchor Facts, and we'll also review a few of the crucial concepts pertaining to government and some of the interesting ways in which Sparta embodied different features of different ideas. And we're going to close in on the final answer, or the best answer we can come up with a little bit more evidence today concerning what the life of an individual Spartan was like. We'll see that There's kind of two parts to it. Life in Sparta was certainly very different than in modern times. So we'll have to look at what was life like for men and what was like life for women, because they're definitely completely separate back then. But regardless, we'll see what a regimented life they lived, and what the significance of that is. We'll be in a better position to finally assess when we have it all in front of us, probably, say, early next week. So that's where we're going with that. By the way, I didn't get a self-test on the class webpage today. I guess I myself need a little bit of I have to get back into the groove of producing those on your behalf. I think it's a good thing to do. I think that a few people have commented on the value of having those little questionnaires to guide them in terms of what they're paying attention to in the lectures, and I intend to continue to do those. But I did forget to do that today. I'm not yet really kind of back in the rhythm of things, but I do intend to resume self-tests as soon as I can. So anyway, getting back to the broad context of things, we have, this is what we were able to get to yesterday in order to fill in the connection, some of the connections that exist between modern life and ancient times. And of course, I think it's worth reinforcing the specifics, the details, the really compelling storylines in today's America and in today's world concerning the connection. And of course, I think the most compelling one, which we mentioned yesterday, is the fact that Americans are going to vote in an election this year. And so that is a really elegant demonstration of this connection that we have to the ancient world. That here you guys at this level, at this junior and senior high level, I try to emphasize the global context, which is why we have all of these timelines indicated here. Even if we don't have details associated with them, we know that the histories of these civilizations are progressing over the time periods indicated. And what we don't have anywhere, except one place. I mean, inevitably, there's only going to be one place it's possible there could be parallel developments in different societies, but in human history, there is not. In human history, there's only one place ever in which there was this innovation of democracy. That aspect that, of course, people are so focused on right now when it comes to voting, right? Because Americans are going to vote for president. And consequently, people discuss the various features of democracy in modern times. And you'll see a lot of discussion about that. And especially as the election approaches and as people discuss some of the features of the election, especially if there are controversies arising out of the voting, which are certainly not hard to anticipate. It'll be interesting to see how elections go in American history in the next few cycles. because I've been noticing, as a historian, I've been noticing that we are, that the United States in particular is really experiencing some issues, some difficulties with regard to the way that the electoral system works and the inability of Americans to understand that system and some of its more crucial and virtuous features. And so it's going to be interesting to see how this current election goes and what controversies arise in the context of that election. And of course, given that Americans don't understand clearly what a republic is anymore, because they haven't learned their history properly, which is historians' fault, then what they're going to want to see done. And so it's going to be a very interesting thing to see. And it all stems back to this. This is the dual heritage. Nothing about the 2016 election would be what it is without this. And so this is the only path that it follows. This wonder that is modern government and modern society with all of its freedoms, and it doesn't happen without this. So that's what we're here to study. And of course, it's mostly Athens and partly Rome. And today we'll get into now more of the details. But just to for today, I don't want to spend too much time on the overall picture, even though there's more to recapture. Let's just fill in the rest of the details concerning the civilizations of Greece and Rome, which are indicated in gray here. We've got two other things that I'm using as anchor facts currently and up to this point. And so we have one other thing that is just so momentous in terms of its impact on history, right? And so that is reflected in the calendar. And it's reflected in cultural values throughout the Western world. And so, of course, what am I referring to here? Kenny, go ahead.
The birth of Christ.
Okay, right. So, birth of Christ. And, well, technically, historians have done their best on this project. And it's not easy to do. And they are, well, yeah, I can't say there's a consensus because it is a controversial topic, and it's a very loaded topic, because for some people it's much more than just a historical issue. So it's we're not exactly sure when it happened, but we're going to go with the most historically accurate date, which is circa 4 BC. Okay, so we have the presence of Christianity in the timeline. Nothing of the modern world, and its particular character could possibly be explained without reference to that as well. So this is just staggering in terms of what's going on in this ancient world and the way that it gradually is transmitted to us here and now. Okay, and then we have a fact that I have set up as an anchor fact as well, which doesn't necessarily feel as momentous, let's say, and it's, but I'm using it as a fact to mark the advent of Greek civilization, and thus to help us begin to know ancient history on a slightly higher level, which is the ability to connect the different parts of it to each other. Right? Because what's the main function of an anchor fact? I consider that to be kind of the beginning of historical awareness. But what is the main function of an anchor fact, Theo?
To connect us to the present.
Yeah, to connect past and present. But as it turns out, all anchor facts are also the most essential facts of all for connecting past and past. There are two different kinds of integration there. They're connected and necessarily complementary. You got to be able to do both of them. And part of the writing that you have done, especially the rise of Athenian democracy, is an example of the latter kind. The type where you need to be able to integrate the past and the episodes of the past and the periods of the past and form up a logical whole concerning the past. Because it's not just about those direct connections, past and present. Democracy, where does it come from? 508. That's part of it, but that's really the beginning. It's the proper beginning, but it is only the beginning. And then after that, you've got to develop a more sophisticated awareness. And that's what translates into a whole other kind of awareness concerning the present. Ultimately, it always comes back to the present and what you're going to do with it, right? Because what's the reason? What's the purpose for doing any of this is to learn something that's going to be useful here and now and have benefits here and now. And if you learn to integrate different episodes of the past, here's the skill you're going to learn in part. And connected to all the other things, too. But if you learn to read the logic of the flow of events, and then you develop that as a general skill, as a mindset, the ability to do that, then if you turn to the present and apply it, what capacity do you that you obtain there? What's the outcome? What's the benefit of having that ability? If you can then transpose it and look at the present and look at the events that have been, the trend in the events that you're observing around you, what do you get from that? Well, you guys are at the early stage here, so you haven't quite grasped this yet, and that's fine, but we are going to really push this theme because the power I'm looking talking about here, Keen, is what?
Is my audio okay?
Yes, it's okay.
Okay, so basically you can predict the future in a sense. It's a little bit over the top to say it that way, but you can sort of start to see what could happen next based on what's happening right now in the present.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you understand what you're saying when you say predict the future, then there's no over the top about it, right? As long as you don't have the wrong conception of what it is that you're saying there, then it is an entirely valid statement to make. And so, for instance, you know, if you were alive in the 1930s and you were historically minded, and you watched events in Germany, and you predicted the onset of World War II, well, there's nothing over the top about that, right? Especially as you continued to observe the events, and you observed the appeasement of Hitler, and so on, you would have had, increasingly, a high-resolution picture of the future. And you would have seen it, and you would have known, especially if you were living in Germany, to get the heck out of there. And or living in France or anywhere around Germany. That would have been the time to make your move and get over to America. And these things are, it's possible to see the world with that kind of clarity. And that's the stuff that you really want. You know, and a lot of people talk about different things that this or that president does and this or that event that's going on in American history. And then they do make all kinds of over the top predictions and wild and reckless kind of statements about the significance or this or that. And that gives historical prediction a bad name. But that's just because they really don't know what they're talking about. And it's sad, and neither do historians, because historians have given up on connecting past and present. So they're not teaching that skill anymore. But it is a capacity that human beings have, and it can be used and exercised very properly and very usefully. It's definitely something worth pursuing. Anyway, going back to this, I was kind of emphasizing this point about this particular fact that I chose as the beginning of Greek history. I wanted to do that to anchor the narrative of the rise of Greek democracy for you, right? Because 508 BC is the end point, but then, well, okay, how did that happen? right? If we don't know when the story started, well, then it's a lot harder to figure out what the significance is of the end of the story. I mean, if let's say Greece was established in 509 BC, and then all of a sudden it's a democracy right away, well, that would be a whole other story, right? Or if Greece was established, like ancient Egypt, circa 3000 BC, and just had this nice, steady flow of events, right? And then finally 508. Well, that would also be a very different thing. And so understanding the rise of something in history definitely involves understanding its context and then putting it in its place. So that's part of the reason why I'm highlighting another anchor fact so far. And then the other reason is, well, in fact, this is part of our Greek heritage as well. So, circa 776 BC, what do we have there? What did the Greeks do in 776, that gives us that useful marker? Theo?
The Olympics.
Okay, the first Olympics. All of the events in ancient history were dated to the Olympics. Remember yesterday we looked at AUC. That was a later Roman dating system, but all Greek events in Greek history were dated from the first Olympics. And that's another cultural heritage that we have, right? It's something that we do in modern times that celebrates our civilization in the sense that we've got disagreements. We have a lot of things that we have trouble sorting out. But we set those things aside and the world comes together, so to speak, right? And celebrates this festival. And it's a symbol of unity. And it was to the Greeks as well. And here's a good segue into today's discussion, further discussion on Sparta, right? Because in ancient Greece, the Olympics highlights the unity of the culture, but it also highlights the fact that the culture was not really a single national culture. What was it? How did the Greeks self-identify? How did they live? To be Greek was by extension. What were they instead? In more fundamental terms. Juliet?
Greece was essentially a collection of city-states.
Okay, city-states, right? So an Athenian was from Athens, Spartan was from Sparta. That was not just the city, it was his country. The patriotism that he felt, if you try to imagine, you know, that feeling of singing the national anthem or of such things to the extent that you have them, even though you're quite young, right? But or you see it in the faces of adults or in their behaviors. And that in Greece was directed to the city-state. That was your country. So let's now go and talk about Sparta again. Because what was this particular loyalty that Spartans felt? How did it, you know, what did it tell, what does it tell us about them? And what was their life like? Is going to be a very revealing aspect of Spartan culture, and it'll tell us more about how are we going to come up with the right name for Spartan government? Because we have, so quickly let's do some review of some concepts here. We do have features of monarchy. Which means what, Rosie?
Well, it means that, there's one ruler.
There we go, monarchy, rule of one, right? Okay, except in Sparta we don't have one ruler, we have two. Now what's the silly name that we have for a system with two kings instead of one? Kenny? Duarchy, right? Okay, so Sparta was a kind of duarchy, which is interesting, and we talked a little bit about the dynamics of a duarchy. We talked about the fact that, well, both kings had to agree on a certain policy, and if we're looking back from a kind of a perspective, an expectation that a government is something that protects people's rights, well, we could look at that like the founding fathers might have and say, well, hey, that's an interesting innovation because you got to have an agreement between the two kings, and therefore we're taking that power and we are, well, what's a good word for that? We are mediating it or mitigating that power, which because we know power corrupts, it's going to lead to the tyrannical conduct of a king. If there's two kings, we have, what's the phrase for that now? As we take the power and we peel off aspects of it and we break it up, what are the technical phrases for that? Nemo?
Duarchy?
Well, we already have... No, duarchy is the two kings. What do we call it when we take the power of a king and we break it up? And we assign it to different officials. So far, we've only got two. Juliet?
Distribution of power.
Yeah, distribution is not such a bad word, but you got to do something in order to distribute. We call it the separation of powers. Okay, so that is a phrase, and in American history, people refer to that as checks and balances, once again. So this is something that the founders were definitely interested in, is check, because the different power of the different officials, they check each other, and they balance each other, right? And we hope that the way that it functions is they stop each other from doing things that are injurious to rights. And in Sparta, there were more than just the two kings. There were five ephors. And their job was to make sure that the Spartan kings followed the laws of Sparta. Well, that introduced then another dimension into our puzzle, right? Because if you have a set of laws that even the king must follow, what do we call that? Applied to monarchy, we could call it one thing. Applied to duarchy, we could call it another thing, Theo.
Well, a constitution.
Yeah, we call it a constitution. So if we're going to modify the concept duarchy, we're going to say constitutional duarchy would be a pretty technical analysis of what Sparta was. And not a bad term, but not quite my favorite. Because now what I want to do is I want to look at the life of a Spartan. The Spartan life was very peculiar. It was unique in all the societies you will ever see. And again, we're already sensing, right, with these different innovations, these different particular features of the government, that it's one of a kind, but it's even more one of a kind. In more regards is it unique in history, and it very much has to do with the life of a Spartan. So we already saw that the commoners and the slaves. I'm not going to bother with the Greek names anymore. We'll just go with commoners and slaves. The commoners and slaves had no right to their own life. And so they were entirely disposable by the state. And we saw as well, just to recall one particular point, the slaves were owned collectively in Sparta, remember? Which means that the government owned them. Nobody owned any individual property in the form of slaves or in fact, in any other way. And really the ultimate statement of Spartan life was the fact that the concept of ownership didn't exist. It was repudiated in Sparta. Theo, that triggered something?
So I had a question about the whole slaves being owned by the government. If, like, for example, a guy wanted to use a slave, would he have to, like, go to the government and ask to borrow one? Or how would that work?
Okay. Well, that premise, your premise there is that a guy, as you say, would have his own farm that he would then, you know, want to go to the government and rent a slave or something like that. And, well, I just, you know, almost precluded your question by explaining that Spartans didn't own property. So there was no such situation in which you could imagine that a Spartan would even encounter such a problem, right? He's not sitting there on his farm thinking, well, I need some slaves now to harvest the grain or what have you, right? It's just that he doesn't have such a thing. So let's talk about this life of a Spartan now, because then that is going to be very revealing about that particular issue. So we're going to start right at birth. Right at the beginning. Why not? So, this one I don't talk about with the elementary students because it is very disturbing. But sometimes you guys are in the abstract ready to hear certain things, even though they're not easy to hear. So, at birth, a Spartan child was assessed for physical viability. In other words, we can't call him a doctor, but, you know, somebody literally from the government. It wasn't the father, it wasn't the mother. A government official assessed the baby. And if the baby was found to be deficient in any observable way, the baby was, I'm going to use a euphemism here, exposed. So this is where we start to get a picture of Spartan life. So what do we mean by exposed? Well, basically left in nature. And of course, you know what's going to happen as a result. So what is going on here? How could there be such a society that would act this way? I mean, most human beings have a powerful, right, instinctive desire to protect and shelter and nurture children and babies, right? I mean, it is just such a natural thing. So here we are talking about the very beginning of Spartan life, and it is a government initiative. It is entirely impersonal. It is entirely heartless. The government looks at the baby and says, this baby deserves to live or not. Okay, what is going on here? Well, the Spartan state did not want handicapped children or any child whatsoever that was not going to be able to contribute fully, did not want any kind of weakness in the state, because an individual in Sparta was not an individual, had no inherent rights, had no inherent worth. An individual in Sparta was deemed to be worthy only insofar as he contributed to society. So the first test of whether or not you're going to be a contributing member of society is whether or not you're physically capable. You are going to be able to grow into a fully formed human being or not. And if you're not, then there's no acceptance. And it was entirely formulaic. It was entirely heartless exercise of choosing the worthy babies and the unworthy ones. So that's pretty ominous, isn't it? And then, well, assuming you were allowed to live, then you were raised by your mother until you were 7. So you got to have that cozy life of a Spartan baby and be nurtured by your mother until you were 7, But then at that point, the government came back and took you from your home forever. So that's it. You were raised by your parents until you were seven, your mother especially. So you're seven, and that's it. You left home at that point. Now, I want to emphasize we're talking about males here. So we will talk about females as well, because in Spartan society, we can't expect to apply modern norms to how things would go back then. And in archaic societies, men and women were absolutely unequal always, and so, yeah, we're talking about two different things here. Right now, we're talking about the men. So at age seven, the government would remove you from your home, and you would live in a public school for the rest of your childhood. And that public school was not just your school, it was your home. You lived in what was called a herd of children, and it was an entirely collective existence. And the primary purpose of your education at that young age was to toughen you up. So the main subject was physical education. Not grammar, or science, or history, or literature. So the main subject was physical education. The main objective of Spartan education was to turn you into a powerful warrior. So they're starting at age seven to toughen you up physically. You weren't fed enough. You were given a single cloak, and so the point was you were going to be cold at night. You were going to be hungry all the time, and you know, you're going to get tough, or you're not going to make it. And part of getting tough is, well, if you got to steal food, well, that's what you're going to do. And you know, if you get caught, certainly you're going to get punished. You'll be flogged, but that'll toughen you up too. Or you'll learn not to get caught, or you'll learn to go without. Either way, at the end, you're tough. You're not necessarily nice. I don't feel like, you know, this is the kind of, you're not going to, I don't think anybody here is going to be choosing a Spartan best friend at any time here, but you're going to be tough, right? And that certainly is the point. And then gradually you're getting exposure to other subjects. You are getting a little bit of music and poetry as part of it, your education. But the purpose of these things is not to soften you up and turn you into an artsy kind of a person. The music and the poetry were also allied to the purpose of education, which was make warriors. So, of course, the theme of the art was the exaltation of the warrior, the promotion of the duty, the concepts of virtue and duty and strength and courage and so on that are required in order to foster the development of the warrior. So I picked out a poem for you guys today having to do with Spartan, the Spartan ethos, we could say. An ethos is a fundamental posture towards life. And I thought it was a good one because I found this page, and if you want to, if you feel at all, if you like poetry, for instance, and you want to perhaps do a project that might be nicely complement History at Our House, it could be a really interesting one to do, to find Spartan poetry and read it. And you can Google it, or you can have your parents Google it, or what have you, in order to find it if they want to filter the results for you. And you might be able to find some quite amazing poetry. I always enjoy good poetry when I encounter it, but I don't often seek it out. Sadly, I didn't learn poetry appreciation when I was young, so it's always a little bit of an effort for me. But I did find this website, and then I found this particular poem, and it really I really enjoyed it. So I thought we'd read this one together in class and talk about it a little bit and just see what kind of poem would you learn in Spartan education, right? And what types of values were being transmitted to the youth by this kind of literary education. So here we have a poem called Walls and the City. So I'm going to read it, and then we can just have a little discussion. You can follow along here. Not homes with beautiful roofs, nor walls of permanent stone, nor canals and piers for ships make the city, but men of strength. Not stone and timber, nor skill of carpenter, but men brave who will handle sword and spear. With these you have city and walls. What do you think? What's the theme of the poem? What are city and walls? Why is it called Walls in the City? What are city and walls here? This is, let's not be too literal. Let's be poetical. What are city and walls? Think about every culture. Egypt, Mesopotamia, what have you. What is city and walls? Juliet?
Safety, perhaps.
Sorry?
Safety.
Okay, safety is part of it, yes. But safety for whom? I mean, what kind of people? What, when people settle down, right, they're not nomads anymore, and they make cities and walls, what are we talking about here? What is this process? What is emerging when human beings build cities and walls to surround the cities? What is that a symbol of? Why do it? Theo?
The defenses of the city, maybe?
Yeah, certainly. The walls are the defenses of the city. But the point is that a city is... Rosie?
Well, I was just thinking maybe it was like because they weren't exactly very strong.
Well, we're getting to the point about strength, right? Because what is a city? It says right here, a city is, what makes a city is the question. Okay, but the question is, what is a city? A city is civilization. Okay, in ancient Greece, the city was the country. It was the cradle of life. If you didn't live in a city, you didn't live. You weren't really human. We'll see that in the story of Socrates as well. And it was such a powerful symbol to the Greeks, the importance of the city. That was what made you different than the barbarians. Your citizenship. Your participation in the city. Okay? And so, what then makes civilization? How do you get it? What is the essence of it? Is it homes? Walls and canals and piers? So it's kind of an elegant, very poetic statement, right? In the first stanza there. He's enumerating different things that you look at when you see a city. Is that the city? Well, it begins with not, right? What is a city? What makes a city, Theo?
Maybe the people who built it.
No, because we only get half of the answer here. But men of strength. But then you ask, See, the poet knows that you might have that conclusion. So the first thing that he says is, not stone and timber nor skill of carpenter. So this is a genius poet because he even knew what you might be thinking. Well, strength applied to what? Not strength applied to construction, but strength applied to what? Julia?
War.
War. Exactly. Without the warrior, there is no civilization. What do you think? True or false? Rosie?
Just sounds like a horrible life.
Well, that, now, so now that's interesting. Now, this is not, I appreciate that remark, Rosie, because there is this issue of, what is this quality of life? So that's a very good comment. And so that's something to talk about, but that's not quite what I was asking. So we can come back to that. And I like that, but what do you think of this point? What about the theme of the poem? Is it true? I think it's a beautiful poem. I think it's very well executed. It's not about rhyme or anything, but I think it's very well structured, and I think it really hits home. Is it true? Guys don't know? Keen, is it true?
Yes. At first, I tried to think about it philosophically to try to get an answer for whether it's true or not. But then I just thought, well, literally, if you just look at history, and you don't have a history.
Darn. Sorry. You're having that internet thing again, which is so awful because I want to hear your comment. Let's just do one more try. Go ahead. Yeah, it's too broken up, sadly. Okay. Unfortunately, I can't make out what you're seeing. So, your answer was yes, and I definitely wanted to hear the details. But anyway, anybody else want to comment on that? Rosie, I'm not sure if your hand is still up from before, or if you're trying to answer this one anew. Which one is it?
Well, I was trying to answer this one.
Okay.
I think it's true and it's kind of false. It's not true for nowadays exactly, but back then it was quite true.
That's a very interesting comment as well, so I appreciate that, Rosie. And so you're saying it's not true today, but it was true back then. And I'm going to contradict you on that one. It is as true now as it was back then. Absolutely. And this is, you know, we've had this discussion, Rosie, about how, I've commented on this, and maybe it was a little bit much for you to take in when I did. I've commented in this class about how warfare has changed and how we live in isolation from the reality of the necessity of violence in human existence. And so we are all insulated, and the American war machine is so incomparably powerful that most people walk around completely insulated from the reality of it and don't get what's going on and what's required in order to have a functioning civilization in the world such as it is. It would be nice to imagine a world in which such was not necessary. Entirely naive to think that it is not necessary. In ancient times, it was more acutely obvious. And that's kind of what Sparta is about. War is in your face 24/7. the life of the of primitive human beings who are trying to claw their way up into civilization is much more stark, much more austere. And so you don't have the insulation from war. And the Spartans were the ones who embraced that, in a sense, rather than try to foster other values in their culture. The Spartans embraced the truth of the necessity of war. In fact, they built their whole culture around it. So it's going to be interesting to compare them to Sparta, to Athens later on. Because the Athenians would have, like anybody in ancient times, would have recognized the necessity of war. On the other hand, they would not have allowed that to become the defining attribute of their culture. The Athenians were the one people in the world that were truly trying to actualize their human potential and redefine life. Remember what I said about the Greeks in general was they came up with a new definition for what it means to be a human being. And as a result, being human beings and involves certain values. It involves pursuing certain values that you can't recognize unless you really have that perspective. The Spartans didn't do that, though. The Spartans completely embraced a warrior culture, in essence. And when you graduated from school in Sparta, just to bring things to a close here for today, at age 18, approximately, when you would do it nowadays as well, right? So today you're thinking about going on to college and all of that stuff. When you graduated from your school in Sparta, there was only one career path. And there was only one goal. Your goal as a graduate was to be chosen to participate in a Spartan platoon, which means a military unit. And the members of that unit would choose you as a graduate and invite you to join. And if you were not chosen, essentially you languished as a second-class citizen. This was everything in Sparta. To become a member of a platoon was to graduate to becoming almost a citizen. You still had to earn your citizenship for quite a big portion of your adult life. You didn't really become a full citizen until you were 30. Having served in the military, so doing the math, that's about 12 years, professionally, so to speak, you were a warrior for the first 12 years of your adult life, assuming you survived that, then you were an aristos. I mean, really, in Sparta, I think we have that concept hardened in a way that you don't see it anywhere else, where you gotta earn the title, right? To be a Spartan, there's nothing automatic about it, right? From birth all the way through to age 30, you gotta earn it. And the standard is service to the state. You as an individual have no right to your life. The only thing that justifies you as a human being is your service. And assuming that you prove yourself through your manly career, then you get to qualify for more service. You get to be in the government. You get to participate in the various functions of government and eventually graduate and perhaps become an E4. Or they're members of the upper reaches of the various forms of government and whatever. Then there are a lot of details that we're not going to, technicalities that we're not going to look at here. But basically, your reward for military service was government service. And that was your life. So, back to Rosie's comment, which I think is a great place to end for today, right? I mean, what a life. Doesn't sound very appealing. from a modern perspective, it's really dreary, isn't it? Bleak. And yet, going back to the question, is it necessary? Well, here's an interesting thought. If it weren't for the Spartans, we wouldn't be here. So we can say that about various things in history. For some things, it is much more apt, much more compelling truth than for others. And we couldn't be here if the Athenians hadn't invented democracy. We couldn't be here if the Romans hadn't had their republic. We couldn't be here if the founding fathers hadn't declared their independence, and so on. So those are our anchor facts, right? Those are things that people did in the past, which are so fundamentally important that they underlie the world as we know it. It doesn't exist without them. And that is true of the Spartans as well. Now, we don't look to their culture and copy that. We don't feel as though we want to be like them because, well, you're not going to get any internet from the Spartans, right? You're not going to get any stem cells from the Spartans, right? They're never going to produce those aspects. You're not going to walk on the moon and whatever else, right? You can imagine, given the wonders of modern technology and so on, right? So what good are they? But final comment, which again is why I love this poem. Without the men of sword and spear, there is no city. We'll see that in the Persian War. Without the Spartans, there is no Western civilization. Not because of anything that they transmitted to us in the form of history or philosophy or science or art, but because they defended it with their lives. And for that, we do owe them a debt. We should know their story. We should think about them. We should marvel at who they were, as strange as it is and as unpleasant in many regards as it is. There's something that there's a thrust that they gave to history that nobody else gave, and which is non-optional. Without them, we wouldn't be here. Interesting stuff, is it not? Okay, so next time we'll talk a little bit also about the life of women. We'll talk about married life. We'll talk about a few of those other dimensions. And then we'll look at some of the crucial events in the history of Sparta, which will carry it through to that point where, you know, Athens is a democracy. Sparta is what it is. We'll name it, finally. and then they'll be side by side. And we will see that, well, they'll be drawn together. And that will be a challenging dynamic. But they'll do things which will change history forever. Alrighty. So far, so good. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye.